Good morning. In the next 30 or 35 minutes, what I hope to do is share with you just some high-level insights, and by no means are they complete, but I think they represent a good cross-section of some of the areas in the evolution of digital technology and digital pathology. And you'll see as I go through my first few slides, I define digital pathology to be really more than just whole slide imaging. And whether you agree or disagree with me on that, it's an opportunity for us to have a discussion at the end when we have the panel. But I would offer to you that really digital pathology represents the opportunity for encompassing all of information technology in areas which are now largely covered by manual technologies or manual processes, which in and of themselves represent opportunity for error and risk to patients. So if you look at the whole opportunity for amelioration of our current workflow practices, just from the perspective of patient care, patient safety, there's tremendous opportunities for leveraging IT in the digital pathology continuum. Just as a matter of disclosure, I have affiliations with a number of organizations, both at the National Cancer Institute and NIAID, and several companies, but nothing I'll discuss today specifically ties to any one commercial product or service. So looking at the larger context of pathology leading to the digital pathology department, I think we'd all agree it's coming at us quicker and perhaps a little bit quicker than some of us realize. I don't know if you can read that. It's saying objects in the mirror are closer than they appear. So we're really looking at a reality where some of these technologies may take us by surprise. And by that, one would be the emergence of patient safety and operational gains by the use of the collective technologies that represent digital pathology, as I mentioned already. And while not all the changes are immediately imminent, there's little question that the transformations will in fact happen and will in fact be sooner than later. So, I mentioned that it's really a question at this point not a question of if, but when. And I'm actually going to make some projections, although I reserve the right to be entirely wrong in those projections, but they're our best guess. And this should not be considered as something to be feared but embraced. So those of you who are Douglas Adams fans might remember Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and I'll just suggest to you to enjoy the Vogon poetry. So some comments that have been made by people I've known over the years, for example, this wonderful quote, "Digital pathology is a technology of the future, and it always will be." Bob Colvin from Mass General 2001. So I think he's, in essence, being proven wrong by the fact that we are seeing significant inroads. And also this quote, by 2000, the year 2000, our microscopes will be collecting dust in the corner. Any guess who said that? Ron Weinstein, 1992. So that was, a considerable time ago. Obviously, he was very optimistic, and I share his optimism, but, predicting exactly when the transformation takes place, can be challenging. So I will define digital pathology as being, obviously use of digital technology for gross and microscopic imagery. I'll add to that elimination of paper. How many of your practices have a paper-free workflow model? And I mean truly paper-free. I'll give it to you. Okay, half. Okay. Well, that's out of your control, right? Because you're... Okay, so that's good. We have usually when I ask that question, it's a zero. So this is a quantum leap. Oh, that's coming. There's a plant in the audience. I actually have a slide dedicated to just that. And then total ownership aspects of workflow and not even be in a present radar. So, CRM modules. How many of you implement at present customer or, by serendipity of English, CNC, or you could say clinician relationship management modules? So a small number. So this is a trend which will be part of the digital pathology workflow continuum. Real-time asset tracking, very helpful, and can be rolled into the overall digital capability of your IT infrastructure. By show of hands, how many people have some or a significant contingent of barcoded asset tracking through their entire workflow? So a very, very small number, again. So things seem to cluster, where we see deployment of IT solutions for reporting. We see similar deployment of IT solutions for tracking and internal workflow metrics. And of course, then opportunity to use Lean, Six Sigma, and other types of quality monitoring, quality improving approaches to minimize patient risk and maximize quality, at the same time hopefully improving efficiencies. And then two final key points, acceptance and adoption of human factors engineering. There's many, many applications that have been written over the years where that really wasn't a consideration, or perhaps not even possible in the days preceding graphic user interfaces. And so we have whole generations of legacy applications based on terminal services, which are fixed text, which are really quite difficult. And that's just a user interface issue. And then the sequence of data entry, whether it be an old or new system, can be quite important in the effectiveness of an application to be both safe and efficient. So I've seen a number of times applications that went from the legacy architecture to modern systems and slowed down processes appreciably. How many of you have seen that, where you went to the latest fancy Windows application and there were too many mouse clicks and tabs and whatnot that just made it horrible, and you wanted to go back to your old terminal thing because at least all you had to do was hit a number, enter, 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 and you were done. So without cognitive insight in what makes an interface effective, IT can actually be part of the problem and not part of the solution. And then finally, knowledge-based management of every aspect of our core business, and not letting those aspects of our core business slip away to other interests within the healthcare enterprise or outside interests. And all the above is really made possible by the rational deployment information technology solutions. So as an overview, I'd like to cover just high-level topics from where we've traveled, review some of the key strategic stages, and this is at a strategic level for the digital technology, digital pathology continuum that will emerge, in fact, will emerge in our practices, look at some of the technology evolution itself. And then one key point, which I think has not really been readily enacted within software models, but is important, is the recognition that we're undergoing right now a transformation from a transactional model for information exchange with various entities to a relationship model, which is really the notion that even federation itself, federation of databases and architectures, is not enough. There's a post-federation model, which I'll share with you. And then finally, evidence-based approaches to re-engineering our workplace and the human factors engineering that ties into that. And I'll give some examples with asset tracking as an exemplar. And then some closing remarks on cultural adoption and managing of the process of change, which, as it turns out, and I've spoken with many of you during the meeting this year, it turns out the IT for many of these problems, the information technology deployment or even development, is far easier than the management of human relations and implementation of change. So, for example, using the LITS interop process as a social engineering experiment, as I mentioned 2 days ago, the IT component was far easier than the engineering of sets of relationships, which are not just one-to-one, but really a complex group of people and organizations, such that we could result in an optimal outcome. By a show of hands, how many of you have tried the LITS interop experience so far? Great. And since I've heard uniformly that it's been working, how many of you were unable to get a satisfactory output from it? Really? Okay. So Dennis will have to talk. Okay, excellent. Just one instance. Okay, so the rest of it was okay for you? Okay. We'll take that offline. So if you look at the notion of, I'll specifically focus on anatomic pathology because that's really more germane to digital pathology from the sense of whole slide imaging, but really much of what I discuss is equally germane to the laboratory continuum. But as this example would be, the card file system. You know, 30, 40 years ago, before the pervasive implementation of computerized records, things were based on card files. And actually, it worked remarkably well for generations, but wasn't scalable and wasn't immediately useful in the sense of sharing between institutions. And so what has happened, and this really ties into Ray's comment a moment ago, is with automation and use of computer database architectures, what it has allowed us to do first and foremost is massively print lots and lots of paper, because now you have the print, you have the computational layer assisting you in the generation of paper. So how many of you experienced when you first computerized your practice that, if anything, paradoxically, you were generating more paper than before? Oh, okay, that's good. So the maybe not contemporary, but for those of you that remember that transition, do you remember printing more paper than before? Don't be shy. Okay, so Don does. Okay. And this was a problem that resulted from the lack of cogent solutions in applying information technology without really looking at the human factors component and the workflow. So that, you know, just because you can print a document at some point in the workflow doesn't necessarily mean you should. It's certainly easy to do so, but that doesn't mean it's the appropriate step. So without appropriate workflow engineering or workflow analysis, which was really quite lacking in early architectures, the computer really has, and the automation has the potential to reduce your overall efficiencies. Some of the areas where we right now have opportunities for improvement and can be considered as strategic opportunities are tracking. We still do not have comprehensive use of automated barcode tracking. The most recent study by the Rand Institute suggests that right now that's about 8% of anatomic pathology practices have some degree from a little bit to 100% within their operational modes in their laboratories. That's not a very good number. Lack of LIMS type concepts. So by that I mean the ability to track not only your results, but the assets that contribute to your results. So if you're in a laboratory, histology for example, and you have lot numbers of stains or antibodies, being able to identify when you have a lot failure, which blocks, which cases you have to go back and carry out additional or repeat studies. That's a typical thing in a research or laboratory information management system that wouldn't be present in a typical lab system for AP or even CP. That's changing, though, especially with the onset of molecular testing. Lack of standards. This has been mentioned a number of times through the meeting the last 3 days, and I'll mention it again. There's ongoing effort, of course, to unify to hopefully a very small set of appropriate standards, but the reality is that in the setting, for example, of interoperability of records, there is no one standard at this point. So the whole premise with the LITS interop exercise was to show that at least technically it's possible, which are the first set of standards, of course, is having organizations, vendors, the academic communities, community-based practices agreeing to share information, and then having a construct, one or more, hopefully a minimum number of constructs, to enable that exchange. Once that relationship or set of relationships is in place, it's now possible to look at the data model and the semantic model of the data which itself is exchanged. So as Ian Ford had mentioned several days ago, there's great benefit in looking at a bottom-up modeling perspective of how you represent the semantic model. But without the relationships to leverage that semantic model, the model itself falls flat. So you really need the top-down and the bottom-up approach. And I think that with the type of developments which have occurred over the past 2 years specifically, we're really as a specialty for both lab and AP at a point where that top-down and concurrent bottom-up development can occur concurrently with the thought leaders and the stakeholders of both of those groups participating in a development effort together. So strategically, what will happen is convergence of standards. And so strategically, what will be extremely beneficial to the practice model of pathology will be for just the general field to make note of what those developments are and then identify the trigger points at which they can be effectively implemented. So a key point is that standards are no longer a curiosity. As we move forward, they will transition to a mandatory component of our relationship building strategies as we build relationships for intramural or extramural linkages for our information systems. The previous notion of let's build another HL7 custom interface because we know that works, while that certainly at an operative level would result in a successful interface, at the total resources management level will prove to be increasingly unacceptable because the plurality of interesting interfaces that one would want or need will exceed available resources. In other words, we clearly are at a trajectory of unsustainability for the level of complexity that we envision. And the way you mitigate that is coalescing that plurality to a very short list of interfaces which serve multiple purposes and scalable interfaces. So if we find as a profession at some point that an interface is inadequate, we extend it without damaging the work we've done previously. And that's the notion of extensibility, which is intrinsic to XML itself, extensible markup language. It's part of its very name and definition. And then finally, several points. The lack of recognition that AP workflow transcends the pathology department boundaries. Simple case study, if you look at one of the largest contributors to misidentified or improperly identified or lost specimens coming from surgical suites and medical procedure suites, it's the fact that pathology as a specialty generally doesn't own every step of the life cycle of that specimen. There's parts of the life cycle which are out of our control because they're in the, quote, spatial domain of surgery, which is understandable. Surgeons have to have facilities and proceduralists have to have facilities in which to carry out procedures and surgery. But the specimen, once it's created, should immediately be tagged with our workflow, or at least with a partnered workflow where there's a linkage to the surgical information system so that there's absolutely no question about the identity of a specimen the minute it comes out of the patient. So basically bedside incorporation of workflow. And so the concept that we have now, which is largely pervasive, of a central distribution or receiving window or desk in the hospital completely severs that continuity model in which if the goal is really patient safety and integrity of identification, you still need a receiving location for the specimens, yes, but the identity should have been carried out far earlier. And so we need to break down these traditionally department-driven dotted line relationships in the setting of looking at our workflow. So there's opportunities here to partner with other specialties to build workflow which is targeted to the use case and not to the department divisions. And that's really a strategic opportunity that doesn't happen all at once. It's something that we need to foster by an iterative process of engaging the outside specialties that contribute to the incoming diaspora of specimens that we deal with and create a seamless process by which one of the major issues, which is misidentification, can be partially or eventually completely mitigated. Many of the errors we have really are inexcusable from a simple tracking model if appropriate continuity measures are put in place from an IT perspective. And that ties into the final bullet point, that workflow and reporting approaches still represent a significant cumulative risk. So there's the analytical and pre-analytical, as I've mentioned, and finally the post-analytical is our metric of success for generating a result. If you look currently, for example, at the CAP checklists, the metric of competency is periodically, once a year, twice a year, looking at the downstream system, if it's electronic interface, and verifying that what you sent, what you have locally, looks like what's on the downstream system. It's appropriately a phase two, but no mention at all of a cognitive loop closing process where for high criticality cases that are unexpected, as Dr. Jeff Myers suggested 2 days ago, that you have an active process to verify actively that those results were not only received but cognitively interpreted the right way by the responsible physician. Because if the goal, of course, is providing the best care to a patient, then we as physicians and healthcare providers within the allied specialties of pathology and laboratory medicine need to go one step further than just kicking out information through data pipelines. I think the real goal is identifying ways to educate the clinicians to the best way to take care of their patients. So if you look at key strategic stages that will enable digital pathology, and again, I don't mean just for whole slide imaging, but really the availability of all the IT layers that will make all of pathology possible. You have, this is from the compliments of the RAND Corporation, estimation of cost effectiveness or storage itself, 2015, 2008, year ago, for the server architectures to be sufficiently robust and cost effective so that you'd have enough servers for the type of information you'd want to process and then transmit. 2014 for whole slide scanners to be sufficiently fast and inexpensive. This isn't to say that in 2014 scanners, a single scanner will be fast enough, but they'll be inexpensive enough that and commoditized that multiple scanners should in fact be appropriate for the typical practices. And we already see examples of this happening at the University of Pittsburgh and elsewhere where there is an attempt ongoing to make an entirely digital AP practice, where glass is basically scanned and filed immediately, and the entire workflow then is, from that point forward, CRT or flat panel LCD-based. In 2013, it's anticipated that network connectivity will reach the critical threshold of 10 gigabits per second for desktop connectivity, and with that realization, it becomes simple to shuttle large slide image sets around and large molecular indexed assay sets to and fro the server to the workstations for interpretation. In 2014, is an expectation that vendor space will be mature with requisite modules that will support these workflows. I mean, already, for those of you that have perused the exhibit floor, there is tremendous effort at present being expended in new types of workflow, in intralab workflow, reporting and data collection that will support these highly, high throughput, massively parallel discovery arrays, which are transitioning now from research discovery to clinical reporting. And then finally, one unknown for me, although the RAND Corporation seems to be very confident about this, but as one of the fellowship program directors of only five in the U.S., that is training pathology informaticists, I have my doubts. But so the question is, by 2015, will there be an adequate cohort of domain specialists in pathology informatics? So taking all these numbers, I would offer you that the earliest likely date that we'd see the exponential phase of the S-curve of adoption is 2015, perhaps later. We shouldn't look at this, however, as a demoralizing or negative consequence. This is actually good news now, because we're finally at a point of bracketing the time window in which we would expect to see more accelerated adoption of digital pathology. So this is helpful, because this gives us about 6 years to start planning for it. And planning, of course, incorporates physical infrastructure, financial planning, which, of course, in the latest round of financial transitions, adds an added measure, a question to how we're going to purchase or fund this additional infrastructure. But nevertheless, just having a better idea of when these technologies collectively will converge at a time to enable one to seriously consider transitioning to an all-digital workflow is not that far in the future, but at the same time is sufficiently far that gives us some breathing time to plan. So I see this really as a good story in the sense that there's time, and yet it's not so far off in the future as to be something that we wouldn't concern ourselves with. So if we look just at some of the evolution enablers of information technology, there's three areas. There's computational, there's storage, and there's network connectivity. And in terms of computational throughput, there's both the notion of transactional load that servers or systems can provide, and the notion of scalability, that as you grow as a practice, can you incorporate additional computational support to be able to seamlessly grow with your volume. And that technology is largely being reduced to practice. Storage is largely commoditized now. One strategic point to think about storage is that it's no longer about the price per terabyte or price per petabyte, that's a given that that price will come down. The strategic thing to consider in storage is availability and resiliency from failure. And so time and time again in the case studies, we see the largest types of failure result from lack of redundancy, not just local redundancy, but lack of disparate spatial redundancy. So the notion of a primary data center and a secondary or even more than one secondary data center is paramount. And yet that's really not the practice for most of our anatomic or lab systems. It's certainly becoming adopted at the enterprise or hospital level, but it has yet to hit the lab and AP level. How many of your implementations, by show of hands, have spatially redundant infrastructure? So a small percentage, perhaps 5 or 10%. So again, this is an opportunity strategically to start considering that high availability, and as I'll mention in a little bit, federated architectures greatly depend on availability, since you no longer have a central repository in all settings, and so the spatial redundancy is important. What is an enabler for spatial redundancy is virtualization. The notion that either a server or a storage farm can be placed over more than one location so that if anyone, or let's say it's a triple redundant system, any one or even two locations fails, from an availability perspective, not only is there continuity of data and services, but there's not a crossover period. Like, for example, the reality we have at Michigan with our primary system, which is the legacy PathNet, it's about 20, 22 years old, primary and secondary servers, which is good, in different rooms and within the enterprise, different data centers, which is good, but the crossover methodology is manual. If we lose our primary, we have to cross over. It takes a few minutes. It could take longer if the appropriate expertise and personnel is not available. Those manual approaches need to transition to absolutely automated and seamless approaches in the service of federated architectures. And then finally, with the notion of seamless failover and distributed architectures, is an increasing availability of software as a service or SaaS or remote hosting. I've had personally bad experiences in Boston with one of the first implementations of a nationwide EHR system, which failed because the local hospital failed to have a locally redundant server and failed to have more than one connectivity point. So when they started jackhammering outside the building, we lost our connectivity. These types of problems now are largely mitigated by redundant pathways, having two carriers for your internet service. But even so, there can be failures at a nationwide internet level. They don't happen often, but they do happen. And in that setting, the question is, what type of fallback strategy do you have in terms of local computational support? So at least if you don't have your major reporting infrastructure, at least you have enough local computational presence to carry out the most mission-critical things, which I would argue would be in the lab for accessioning or for work list progression or operating your interfaces or for your manual benches, having individuals able to use the computer locally at least to progress the steps of the various tests that are being developed. That really right now is an unanswered question and an opportunity for strategic consideration of how to mitigate such missing functionality. And then finally, in terms of digital pathology, specifically pertaining to whole slide imaging, I think increasingly, without meaning to be pejorative at all, these are going to be increasingly appropriately viewed as appliances. They will all adhere to standards. They will have various features, like how fast they can scan a slide, what their throughput is. We will expect the quality is a given, and their adherence to a standard and output file format will be a given. And with that elegant transition to a standards-based approach and competition in the market, the real question is then the rational deployment of such technology matched to your current and anticipated volume. So in many ways, it's the same set of questions that we have now. Which chemistry analyzer do you pick based on your volume or based on your test mix? And I think the same types of questions will be germane to the whole slide scanning platform. And then finally, as an appliance level tool or set, I would offer that modules that can be either purchased directly from LIS vendors or third parties for a customer slash clinician relationship and management software will be very helpful and probably become paramount. And so all of this eventually will become commoditized. So if we look at the history of computation just very briefly, from the original ENIAC machine the federal government had consigned in the late 40s, early 50s, 35 operations per second. And in today's dollars, this would be a $600 million machine. And so if you did an extrapolation of modern supercomputers in terms of dollars that were available in the 40s and 50s to like the Blue Gene, which had 478 teraflops, and then the Roadrunner, IBM's latest supercomputer, 1.026 petaflops, this would be not even in trillions of dollars, but $600 quadrillion approximately in 2009 money. So obviously the economies of scale have smiled on us as far as computation. So you all realize, of course, that the computers on your desktop are supercomputers by 1985 standards. I mean, that's a reality. So we just briefly looked through the evolution, computational throughput. We had the DEC PDP mini computers, which of course through disruptive technology and evolution gave out eventually to the personal computer and modern servers. So in 2009, we actually have on personal computers with dual core, quad core machines, upwards of 3.5 gigaflop technology, which is quite impressive. When we look at the expanding plurality of whole slide scanners, it's again a question of time before we hit the break-even point of the cost of the instrument versus the speed of the instrument to determine how many instruments need to be purchased. And as these increasingly become commoditized, it'll become a question of the specific features that are required for the practice settings of a particular laboratory. So cost of storage, difficulty with image transfer, and difficulty with stewardship of digital repositories are the current strategic linchpins that need to be considered. In current dollars, they would be prohibitive. So that we need to develop tools that will take advantage of data in digital format to mitigate this. And that's actually one of the attractive points of having it in digital format. And one way of offsetting this concern is rationally designed workflow so that we as a specialty can grow into the use of such digital pathology. So the notion is that initially various niches will be better suited for conversion to digital use for the specific use case of digital imaging. And eventually, as economies of scale grow, that can be transitioned to the entire workflow. So I think what we're going to see really is an iterative and incremental adoption of digital whole slide imaging based on areas where it makes the most sense. So for example, in the present model, that would be consultative pathology, maybe even more time acute, would be transplant medicine, where you really have a high need if you need to have a geographically distributed consultation from a consultant far away. Transplant medicine is very elegant. This is Ian Forr's example from CA Big comparing whole slide images to the conventional radiographic model. This, just very briefly, in terms of a par pixel resolution, gives you an idea of how much more massive the problem is in the whole slide continuum for data storage compared to what the radiology specialty has to contend with. And you could argue that this is contributory to why it's taken quite some time for pathology to have the equipment that's able to support these very, very large images. It really was predicated on the availability of machines with larger storage and faster computation to process the larger data sets. So very briefly, a strategic thing to consider in the transition of the worldview of pathology image repositories. Not going to go into this too much detail, but having the image itself is a great opportunity. Yet when we carry out search, and this is one of my personal areas of interest, of searching images with images themselves, the current model for searching image-based databases is either looking at the text associated with the accession, or if you have text associated with each individual image in a repository, it is the metadata and the text that is used for the search and not the image. Yet if we look as a percentage of overall data, it turns out that there's tremendous opportunity in searching the images themselves. So these are actual screenshots of one of the discovery tools we have at the University of Michigan that will actually take a small section as an exemplar and then mathematically generate an equation or set of equations to find ground truth, which then in end could be used to create a montage of cases from a repository that match. So content-based image retrieval. This will be a major transformative change from the availability of digital repositories of images. And we should anticipate significant opportunity for improvement in the quality that we can deliver, both diagnostically, educationally, and discovery, from the availability of starting to use the images themselves and not text for search. However, there's some challenges in looking at these large repositories. I won't belabor this, but if you do the math conservatively on a 1,000-slide practice, in today's dollars, and you add this up over 1 year, do the math, you get, you know, I'm an engineer, so I go by, you know, orders of three magnitude each. So 10 to the 6 gigabytes or 10 to the 3 terabytes or 1 petabyte, 10 to the zero is 1. And you end up with, in today's dollars, $2 million of storage per year, which I think for most practices is prohibitive. However, if you scale this out at the time point, 2014, 2015, that the RAND Corporation predicted, it will be very inexpensive at $11 or less. I mean, a disruptive technology in that sector for hard disk storage, for example, could disrupt the $11 and make it $1. We don't know. I mean, we've actually seen in the curve, though, that things tend to get steeper, which means the growth or acceleration of discovery is accelerating. So there are other modalities, briefly, that could benefit from this. And looking at this as a total percentage of information which we acquire, we already have crossed the precipice so that the far majority in the coming years of the data we acquire and store is no longer the text. Unless my laser pointer, it's the images. And so if we don't search or take advantage of the image component, we're losing a tremendous opportunity. Looking on a linear scale, you can see in terms of absolute storage, I think I got it back, we're really taking off exponentially. And when you take the log of this, here is that acceleration point in current anticipated utilization. The storage that we are exponentially gathering is not linear in log space. It's actually accelerating. Yeah. Thanks. So with massively large repositories, geometric effort expands, making discovery and search very difficult. And that's where the anticipated availability of much better computational storage will address this. So in terms of, this is just a notion about the pathology cockpit. In terms of human factors engineering, I'll skip through this and just point one aspect of federation. And federation allows multiple repositories to serve in real time, creating a normalized data model. And this is very powerful in and of itself, but unfortunately, it has a limitation in that it's generally viewed as a one-way conduit by which a user, let's say a clinician on the far left, benefits from all the various domains, including the laboratory information system. This has served well in terms of data models and is now taking root in a number of hospitals such as MD Anderson. But the missing link here is the fact that we, as pathologists, can benefit from all this information as well. So if you transition this model back where the LIS is a purveyor of the federation as well, this is a reciprocal federation where now our systems, which are earmarked normally as sourcing information, should be viewed strategically as a target for receipt of aggregated information. The notion basically being that our LISs should have a data feedback from the CDR or the other systems in the hospital, such that when carrying out complex interpretation like medical, liver, bone pathology, you can receive the radiographic information, you can receive the clinical history and other things seamlessly in the LIS. Right now, this reciprocal federation is not implemented. as a real model, but it's something that we should strategically consider in the future as an absolute requirement for comprehensive solutions for patient management. Now, in terms of human factors engineering, I'll just mention that interfaces themselves need to be improved, designed shoulder to shoulder for the domain specialist, as well as the coder, so that number of steps, the opportunity for error or ambiguity is resolved. And this requires very tight linkage of the development community with the practice community. And I'm very pleased to see the trend has been over the last few years, this is happening. And if you, in fact, look at the display, the exhibit floor, many applications now have very cogent interfaces that support that. So this is human factors engineering will be an increasingly important component of software design, and we as users of such systems should absolutely demand it. So in our contracts with new systems, we should put in performance metrics, not just how long the system takes to respond, but how long it takes an individual to carry out a particular task at each use case. And this is just one final example. This is the work of one of our lead analysts, Jeff Sika. This took 2 weeks of work working with a domain specialist to make a custom interface for the management of a particular medical entity, in this case, diabetes. And so if you extrapolate that over the plurality of medical specialties, you can see this is going to be a Herculean amount of work to make domain-specific interfaces. But I think this is where we need to evolve strategically to provide the best level of patient safety. And yet, if we look at most of our interfaces, they, in fact, are generic. They're not tied to the medical entity. And by tying something in terms of the history of review of systems and history of illness, as well as the laboratory identifiers, you end up with something which is very cognitively powerful and succinct from a clinical interpretation perspective. And it just goes without saying with asset tracking that this is continuing to evolve, and you can use use case models, lean principles to identify ways of minimizing steps. Although there are more steps from the prior slide to the current slide, 8 of these 9 are automated, and so the total number of opportunities for error diminishes. So just tying it all up in terms of the dark side of the moon for pathology, the areas where we're unprepared, inadequacy of contemporary interoperable solutions, so push standards with your vendors, anticipate that storage will drop in price, a providence of data, understand that data availability is extremely important, and longitudinal stewardship of primary data is very important. Where are we going to keep all these archives for 10, 20, 50 years? Questions that are unanswered but should be considered. And so in terms of sparking the light of success, continuous planning, because what we plan today may not be the future. So this is a reiterative process, very similar to PDCA. Adopt modular solutions that are extensible. Leverage standards whenever possible. And identify solutions that are revenue neutral. So don't implement something if it's going to destroy your bottom line. Wait for the economies of scale to make it at the very least revenue neutral. In that setting, you'll at least be helping your patient from patient safety initiatives, quality of information reporting. And a number of opportunities also exist for improving the revenue stream by partnering with organized medicine, organized pathology, for getting reimbursement models for whole slide imaging itself, for asset tracking, for CRM, and automated interpretive services. And I'll finish with George Carlin, who passed away last year, who actually was a great advocate of pathology. From now on, going to only visit my pathologist. She gave me a nice tour of the lab with all those instruments and flashing lights making whirring noises and even helped me fix my computer. More importantly, she didn't try to place any large, cumbersome instruments through any of my body orifices. I like those traits in a physician. And with that, I'll conclude. Thanks. Yeah.